Craig, it's important we look at the facts.
Why? Why?
Douglas Ross is sounding pretty scared.
I believe in independence.
And he clapped like a seal.
Hello, it's me again, Paul Hutchin, political editor of the Daily Records. I'll be chairing this episode of Planet Holyrood. Joining me on this dreich December day are two Planet Holyrood stalwarts. That's the Sunday Mail's political editor John Ferguson and the Daily Records chief writer Anna Burnside. I should say that John is down in London today. If that looks like a London hotel room, then that is because it is. He's been nominated for a British Journalism Award for his sterling work this year. I think on the SNP police investigation, I may be wrong on that, but I'd be astonished if it wasn't for that. So obviously, John, we wish you all the luck this evening. Are you confident of your chances?
Well, we're up against some stiff competition from the London papers, but who knows?
Well, I mean, I think you've got a good chance. You know, I think that it's set the agenda for so long, your coverage of the police investigation. So I think you must have a pretty decent shout at it.
Excellent. Well, we'll go into it with high hopes then.
Indeed. All right. So I think that the big story this month is going to be the Scottish Government's draft budget and how to fill what seems to be a £1.5 billion black hole. But before we come to that, let's just go back a few days to the Sunday Mail splash, John. Operation Branch Form, which is the police investigation into the SNP finances, it's been pretty quiet of late. Haven't been too many stories about it, but that changed on Sunday, where you reveal that one of the things the cops have been looking at is the purchase of a high-end Jaguar, which I think was worth more than 90 grand. Could you just talk us through the story and the significance of it?
Yeah, that's right. It's a £95,000 electric Jaguar I-Pace. It's pretty much the most expensive model that you can buy. This isn't a new development in the investigation, in the sense that it's unclear exactly when the police started looking at this. It could have been a while ago. Certainly, I've known about the existence of this Jaguar for quite some time. It's just that some new information came to light that allowed us to now write the story, so specifically the fact that it was actually Peter Murrell who purchased that vehicle at a dealership in Edinburgh. Now there could be a perfectly good explanation for this, but it does appear that Peter has purchased the vehicle at the very end of 2019. It's been photographed on his driveway at his home. It's then been, we have been given reports that he was at least trying to arrange to sell the car at a WeBuyAnyCar.com office in Glasgow, sort of late 2021. And the car was indeed, the ownership changed a few months after that, and a new registration plate was put in the car, I assume by a new owner. Certainly the registration and the ownership appears to have changed again just in the last few months, so that second owner didn't own the vehicle for very long at all, and it's now bizarrely appears to be up for sale again. So it's just another high-value item that the police are very interested in investigating in relation to this fraud probe.
John, I mean, first we had the motorhome, you know, the purchase of a motorhome. Now the purchase of a Jag. Folk will be thinking, what's going on here?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it does seem strange that that Peter Murrell would be buying two extremely expensive vehicles in quite a short space of time. Now, perhaps there is a totally reasonable explanation for that. Perhaps perhaps this was some sort of company car. I guess the very interesting question will be that, you know, when all is said and done, if it is the case that there's a perfectly legal explanation for this, will that explanation also be acceptable to SNP members and SNP voters?
Yeah. There was one thing that, another thing I thought was interesting in your piece was, did you say that you thought that cops were looking at maybe around 1,000 individual purchases as part of the probe?
Yeah, so that's something that we have reported before, but there is essentially a warrant that the police have produced with, we've been told, around 1,000 items on it. That's the warrant that Hamza Yusuf has actually had sight of, and it would appear that it's, you know, a long list of basically day-to-day, or everything from day-to-day items of expenditure to these very high-value purchases. It does seem that getting to the bottom of what money was used to purchase all of this stuff and who benefited from this stuff is a key part of the investigation now.
Anna, I mean, every time these stories come out, you could just imagine a loud groan in Hamza Yusuf's office.
Yeah, 100%. I also think that Nicola Sturgeon chose the wrong time to pass her driving test, didn't she? I mean, that vehicle, lay aside the whys and wherefores of why they bought it. I mean, it looks as if it would be quite fun to drive. The other detail I liked in your story, John, is that he's now driving a Peugeot 208, which is really, I don't think has got quite the same, you know, razzmatazz, has it?
It's quite a nice electric Peugeot 208, it has to be said.
I mean, I'm sure he clearly likes cars, and I mean, I'm surely it's a nice vehicle, but, you know, anyway. That's just a little aside, a little observation from me. The way that this has dragged on, and every time another thing comes out, it's another excuse to, first of all, go over all the past details and all the other things that have come out during branch form, and then just another excuse for the anti-nationalist faction to, you know, have an almighty go at the SNP leadership and organisation under Morrill. And while it's a brilliant story, John, and your coverage of all this has been, I mean, exemplary, you have to, the bigger question, I suppose, or the bigger point that comes out of it is, you know, really, is this really the most, you know, this is a distraction from actual politics, isn't it? Like what we're going to come on to talk about next, the budget. And as long as branch form carries on, we're going to be talking about who bought what vehicle when, and using what money, rather than the actual important things of, you know, the fabric of the country falling to bits, our leisure centres going to be closed, are the bins going to get emptied, are children's school hours going to be cut? All these really, really big issues are actually, can't be the full focus of everyone's attention, most importantly, the politicians, as this drags on and on and on and more damaging revelations like this one come out.
I think that's absolutely correct, and I guess there's two things, isn't there? On one hand, we've fraud is a serious issue.
Oh, and absolutely,
it's necessary to get to the bottom of it. But I think where you're absolutely right is that this whole thing is having a material impact on the functioning of Scotland's democracy.
And 100%.
I think that the police really do have and the Crown Office really do have a responsibility to resolve it as quickly as humanly possible, because
I'm not saying at all that you shouldn't be covering it, you know, absolutely the fault isn't in the coverage. The journalism is purely reacting to the kind of glacial pace at which it's going. I mean, someone said on Twitter, you know, that a forensic accountancy company could wrap this up in 3 weeks, and I don't know if that's true or not, but you know, you can't help but thinking they have the police and the Crown Office have made a tremendous meal out of this, and if they could wrap it up, it would be to everyone's advantage.
Thing is, who knows what's going on behind the scenes? This might be a devilishly complicated case. There might be things that we just simply do not know about, and that explains the delay. John, just in a political context, Do you sense there is nervousness inside the SNP that it could drag on and maybe overshadow the general election for them, or become a headache for them in the general election?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I mean, my discussions with people in the Scottish government, I think that they genuinely don't know. They don't know how this is going to be resolved, and they are fully aware that it just means that at any point there could be this cataclysmic event that might not even be a final development. You know, it just means that at every point they can be completely tripped up by something that's 100% out with their control. And so, yeah, they're really worried about it. And yeah, it feels like the longer it goes on, the more likely it is that something happens potentially in the middle of a general election campaign, which, you know, it does feel like there would be something almost unacceptable about allowing that to happen, because it would be having such a big impact on the democratic process and politics. I think one important point, I guess, to make here is that for Hamza Yousaf, he could distance himself from all of this more than he has done, and that's something that is in his control. You know, he has chosen not to expel Nicola Sturgeon from the party, or her husband, or the other people involved. He's supported them. They've been at party conference. They've been getting, you know, standing ovations. He's been mentioning Nicola Sturgeon in speeches. He's standing by her 100%, and that is something that's within his control that he could do to insulate his own government from the fallout from this. An option open to him is to say, until this whole thing's resolved, they're out. We can't have any more to do with them. Perhaps in the future, if they're entirely exonerated, then there's a way back in. But he's not doing that, and that means that the impact is always going to be greater.
All I'll say is I hope there's not a major development on Christmas Eve, just as I'm back on my presence. That's one plea I would make
from the selfish point of view.
Yeah, that's one plea I would make to the Crown Office. Obviously, this is not the last time we're going to be discussing branch form, but just moving on, Anna, another big story this week was the intervention of Lord Cameron, no doubt from his perch in the House of Lords. He sent a spicy letter to the Scottish Government complaining about them meeting foreign leaders. I think it was President Erdogan from Turkey, without FCO officials present. Now, that meeting did generate a bit of a backlash internally within the SNP, it should be said, but just on the issues raised by Cameron, I mean, Anna, who do you think's in the right here?
Well, on the letter of the law, Cameron is right, because foreign affairs are a reserved matter. And Hamza Yousaf, the Scottish First Minister, has absolutely no remit to really be discussing anything of substance with any other world leader. So much as it pains me to say so, yeah, I mean, David Cameron, you know, has a point. I do, though, feel a bit of sympathy with Yousaf, because you don't have many moments on the foreign stage as a Scottish First Minister for that very reason. And, you know, it must have been quite intoxicating for him. You know, he spends, unlike other leaders who do get to go and, you know, shake hands with Zelensky or the American president and, you know, get to do, you know, go and get photographed at the Taj Mahal and get to do, you know, get some of these really glossy, high octane gigs. There's very, very little of that as First Minister of Scotland. So I do think it must be quite intoxicating. And also, Hamza Yousaf obviously has a very personal interest in the Gaza issue. And, you know, put all that together, and yeah, of course he was going to meet Erdogan if he got that opportunity. So I do think Cameron's right, but I do have some sympathy for Yousaf, and I do think I do think it's quite understandable that he would want to take that opportunity.
John, I mean, I suppose my view is that First Ministers of Scotland have always met foreign leaders in terms of promoting us overseas and I don't think there's any issue at all about meeting foreign leaders or foreign ministers when you're talking about devolved issues. But do you think it does cross the line when it veers into foreign affairs, things like Gaza, where clearly the Foreign Office have got a particular line and they feel like the leader of a devolved country is actually undermining that line by having parallel meetings with people like Erdogan?
Yeah, I mean, but it's, as I understand it, this sort of specific complaint from David Cameron is that that Humza didn't have Foreign Office officials present in this meeting, so, and that this was some sort of breach of protocol. So, I mean, I don't know the ins and outs of that. If you take it at face value, I would appear that Humza has accepted there was some kind of protocol breach there. But I do think, well, for me, I kind of look at the wider context here, and you know, you've got Lord Cameron, a completely unelected government minister, who there is a, you know, a real question marks over his character, frankly. Greensill affair, he's a guy who, as prime minister, invited a banker into the heart of government, then took a job with that banker as soon as he was out of government, and within a year or so was aggressively lobbying the government to give this guy millions of pounds of taxpayers' money before his business collapsed into the dust. So, you know, I think it's frankly pretty incredible that we've got David Cameron back in government as an unelected, minister. And it's, you know, there's just something kind of quite unpalatable about this completely unelected guy lecturing the elected First Minister of Scotland on, let's face it, a topic where, I think Humza Yousaf has been incredibly dignified and is, you know, generally regarded as having his interventions on Gaza. The things he's said have been really pretty good and respectable, and you know, he obviously has this personal connection with the situation there. The UK government's position is not to call for a ceasefire. That would appear that is quite out of step with what a lot of the general public think on the issue, and Humza's position seems a lot more in touch with what most people think on this. And it would appear that's definitely the case in Scotland. So, you know, whether a protocol was breached or not, I don't know. Probably there was, but I'm very relaxed about Humza Yousaf speaking out in Gaza and speaking to other world leaders on that subject. So, you know,
the optics of Lord Cameron and all his baggage and the fact that he's not elected lecturing a democratically elected government, it does stick in the throat somewhat. It's like, you know, makes sense.
It's not the first time, though, is it? I mean, James Cleverly had to over Iceland. I mean, it's clearly something that they're watching. You know, they're clearly, they're watching to check, keeping a watching brief on whether first ministers, you know, do more than a kind of iron brew photo opportunity with a world leader, and if there's any line crossing, it's going to be watched and reacted to.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a point there, but I don't think Lord Cameron is a particularly good person to make that point at all.
It feels to me also, I don't know what you think in this, that you get the impression that the UK government, the Conservatives at the moment, they kind of feel like the SNP are weak and they can be kicked around a bit. So you do have to look at this in this wider context of the court cases around the GRR and all these other areas where the UK government seems to view the SNP and Humza Yousaf as weakened and something that they can kind of start to have a bit of sport with, you know, challenge them, slap them down, and that they get away with them. And they seem to have the view that that's going to be looked upon favourably by the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, let's move on to the main item then. Next week's draft budget. I think it'd be fair to say it's going to be a difficult one for the Finance Cabinet Secretary, Shona Robison. The figure doing the rounds is that there's a £1 billion black hole, but since then, the Scottish Government has backed a council tax freeze. I think that they announced about £100 million or so for cutting waiting lists. Then, of course, there's the public sector pay deals they have struck, which will have a knock-on effect next year as well. So the figure is closer to £1.5 billion to £1 billion. Anna, how are they going to get themselves out of this hole? Can they?
Well, with extreme difficulty. I mean, it's an absolutely horrendous situation they're in. And the things that are getting floated, you know, the kind of flags that are being flown about how this is going to happen are all, you know, are all monstrous. Obviously, the most obvious thing to do is a tax hike. And I think this has been pretty well trailed, that there's going to be a new 45% tax rate for people in a kind of high middle, not top, but kind of high middle tax bracket. I think there seems to be some debate over how much money that would actually raise. The thing that I was reading this morning, the SGUC thinks it will raise £92 million, but actually the Fraser of Allen Institute have said, well, you know, as soon as you put a new tax band like that in place, you know, smart people then just readjust how they pay their taxes and where they put what money. And I don't know what these people do. Sadly, I have no personal knowledge of this world to live in. But anyway, the Fraser of Allender Institute reckoned it would only raise £39 million, which for something that actually is quite a nasty headline, which raises the tax gap between Scotland and England, that doesn't to me, and there's, you know, when you need £1.5 billion, £39 million doesn't seem a massive amount of money to make from quite a difficult to sell, you know, unpopular policy. So, you know, good luck with whatever they choose, because none of it is going to be palatable, is it?
John, just on this tax band, which I think might fall on income between around 75 grand to about 125 grand. The Fraser Islander, as Anna just said, been pretty clear, it's not going to raise a huge amount of money. Do you think that it's, if they do that, is that more about sending a signal? Is it performative? Is it symbolic? More than it is about actually based on raising serious money?
Yeah, it does. It's not going to raise £1.5 billion, is it? That's for sure. I think that central government, local government have got real problems coming down the line, and that the only real way that they're going to be able to deal with this is through deep cuts to public services. In terms of the tax, right? I would, you know, if you cast your mind back to those years after the referendum when we had the Edinburgh Agreement, the Scottish government were delighted about the fact that it was viewed as a real victory to get tax or income tax powers from Westminster. And, you know, that is quite a dangerous thing to have. People don't particularly like paying tax, and people don't particularly like feeling like they're paying more tax than people in England, unless they can see demonstrably that they've got better public services. I mean, it's difficult to see how this extra tax band is going to make much difference. I think it's got more to do with the SNP's philosophy that the people with the broadest shoulders in society should take more responsibility and pay more. That's a laudable thing, but it's not going to deal with these problems. And I think the difficulty is that across the board, really, if you really want to raise more money through tax, you've got to do it at every income level, and that's something that people probably won't be particularly happy about. There's the other issue with tax is this thing where inflation is pushing incomes up, so just by leaving the bands as they are where they are, actually that represents a huge income tax increase already. So I think it's a really big problem, not just for Scotland, for the UK Treasury as well. The last couple of rounds of public sector pay rises and inflation has just bet you don't get as much for your money anymore. And, you know, public services are going to be really, really stretched, and the tax burden's probably going to go up for everyone.
I mean, what really pisses me off about this is that they started with a black hole of 1 billion, then they've made it worse through this stupid council tax freeze, because it means they have to find another 300 million for a policy that disproportionately benefits the wealthy over the poor. So they made a bad situation for themselves even worse. And now they're scrabbling around, making cuts, trying to take money from mental health and all these other places in order to give people who live in big houses a tax freeze. So, I mean, Anna, are they not just, you know, are they not partially responsible for this situation?
It's been absolutely. It's been very badly handled. I mean, this is what happens when you make policy, what was it, 12 hours before you announce it at conference, you know, and the there's no time for the sensible people with the calculators who would say, you know, hold the bus, this means X, Y, Z and ABC, and adding this onto the black hole, didn't have a chance to make all these extremely valid points. And so you get an on-the-hoof, headline-grabbing policy for a conference. But once that dopamine is gone, you know, you're left with this just absolutely hideous financial mess that poor Shona Robinson has to try and figure out. I mean, I think that bit has been particularly badly handled. The other kind of running sores that are adding to this problem, of course, are kind of historical financial commitments to the ferry disaster, which just is a running drain on money and has cost just eye-watering amounts of money. And also their historic guarantees to Sanjeev Gupta for his aluminium plant. So those are two great big historic commitments that they're also having to service that you know, are in the background and have to be paid for and have to be looked at. But that, you know, that there's no retail politics in that. You know, there's no gain, there's no feel good factor in that. It's just a big financial commitment that they've got to look after.
John, if you go back to the SNP leadership contest, which was effectively between Humza and Kate Forbes, Humza explicitly pitched himself as the candidate at the centre-left, and Kate Forbes, with some justification, was the candidate of the centre-right. And he said during the contest that his top priority in government would be cutting child poverty. I mean, do you see any sign from what you read in the last couple of weeks that the dial is going to be shifted on child poverty in this draft budget?
It's difficult to see it, isn't it? I mean, to be fair, it's a really difficult thing to do, especially when public finances across the board are so stretched. Obviously, what this week, Humza was, you know, talking about the fact the attainment gap had been narrowed. However, it does, you know, that does appear to be dependent on exactly what figures you're looking at, and the insinuation is that the Scottish government will get a very narrow set. But yeah, I mean, I think it's right that should be Humza's goal, and I think that it's not just something he's saying. I think it's something that he genuinely believes in, and that he is genuinely a centre-left politician who wants to make life better for the poorer people in society. But it's a really difficult thing to do, especially when you're in a downturn in the economic cycle as we are at the moment.
All right, let's wrap it up. Good week, bad week. Anna, over to you.
Okay, well, my choice for good week is Ash Reagan, who much earlier this year predicted that the Scottish Government's GRR legislation would result in a humiliating legal defeat and cost a vast amount of taxpayers' money. And that is her making that very pronouncement. And it turns out she was correct. So that's always a good, you know, it's always a good thing to do, isn't it, to have called it right. Bad week. I hope I'm going to pronounce his name correctly. Altony Craik, who's a Labour councillor in He's a Labour councillor.
This crazy story.
It's the best story. Come on, it's not crazy. It's the best story. He's a Labour councillor in Fife who also writes occult and fantasy novels, by all accounts, extremely lurid self-published ones. And he has had to withdraw as a prospective parliamentary candidate in case these his purple prose reflects badly on the party. I have to say that I think this is the best publicity that Mr. Craig's occult sex fantasy novels could ever have. I mean, I have to say, I'm now quite intrigued. I see my colleague, my friend Libby Brooks, has clearly, who works at The Guardian, has clearly sourced some of them and has quoted from some of them. So I'm going to see if she can maybe forward me the PDF, because I now want to read these. I'm sorry, I know that makes me quite trivial, but yeah, I want to see what all the fuss is about.
My prediction for this selection, where the chap has stood down, is that Labour have probably found a candidate they want, and now they're rerunning the race, and lo and behold, someone favourable to the leadership will come forward and then win the candidacy, unlike Mr. Craig, who was probably going to win it at the beginning of time. So I think it was Irvine Welsh who said, "I've never heard of the guy, but..." And as you say, Anna, his novels now have probably...
Irvine's with me. You know, he now wants to read. He now wants to read about the psychic priest, Father Andrew Steele. I mean, I want to know. And I also have the hope that they're set in Fife, where I used to work. And I have to say, when I was the editor of the Dunfermline Herald and Post, I'd never covered a story as sizzly as this one in the whole time I was there.
And I'll make sure you get one for your Christmas, okay?
Thank you, Paul. That's very kind of you.
No bother. John, good week, bad week?
So I was saying it's a good week for XL bullies in Scotland. The Scottish government has decided not to go along with certainly as quickly of a complete ban. XL bullies are potentially going to be put down in England. There was a story this week that, as a result of this, owners are now desperately shipping all their XL bullies to Scotland to be rehomed, which is good news for the XL bullies, but it might not be good news for other people. I think there's a potential banana skin here for the government. This might have seemed like a policy that would please dog lovers initially, but obviously if it is true that hundreds of XL bullies are now arriving in Scotland from England, if there was to be some sort of incident, I don't think that would look good at all. So a good week for them at the moment, but let's see how that goes. And I think it's been a bad week for Hamza, just in terms of this incident with David Cameron, slapping him down, telling him that he might close down Scotland's foreign offices situated within British embassies unless he starts towing the line on foreign policy protocol. I think that Hamza has to, David Cameron clearly feels that Hamza is someone that can get bullied, and Hamza needs to come back strong when this sort of thing's happening in the future.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. Who knows, maybe it'll be a good week for John Ferguson tonight.
Let's hope so.
Thanks.
Good luck for John.
Right, okay, let's wrap it up. I hope everyone enjoyed the latest Planet Holyrood, and we'll be back next week for a special budget episode. So I hope you tune in.
It's important we look at the facts. Why? Why?
Douglas Ross is sounding pretty scared.
Because I believe in independence.
And he clapped like a seal.